afternoon, listeners, and thanks for joining me on this beautiful, sunny fall Saturday after Thanksgiving. I'm Carolyn Yeager, your host, and the date is November 29th, 2014. This is a leaf falling day where I am. You know, when you look outside or are outside and see leaves flying through the air in a graceful dance, that is something enchanting, and there's a nostalgic feeling about it. The reason I'm sure is because something is ending, the nostalgia, I mean. Something is ending, dying, and that is the full cycle of the year with its seasons and all its richness. The spring, the planting, the summer, the harvest, all the activity now is disappearing. Now is coming the time to rest until a new spring begins. That is what is called bittersweet, something that's always a word that has always been very useful to me to describe emotions that are the most memorable, in a sense. It's that wrenching feeling of something passing, which is never to be again. It can make us appreciate much more keenly what we had, what we have, and for this reason, it is the pure genius of nature. And this, just this, is the secret of life, if we would just learn it. And I'm not very good at learning it, but whatever passes away is reborn. Rebirth is a law of nature and of the universe. Now that part I understand very well. Why should it be otherwise? Recycling is also a law of nature, a process of nature. We see it everywhere. Why should it be different with people? We are also reborn into the never-ending ongoingness of life. And what's more is that life is the true name of God. I discovered that about 15 years ago. It was a revelation. The question was asked, what is the true name of God? I thought about it for a while, wanting to know. I believe that there was such a thing at the time. And, as always, when I want to know something, the answer came, and it was so clear, and I understood it so well. Life. Life was the true nature, the true name of God. Think about it. It might become clear to you also. Well, it was the falling leaves that I looked at this morning earlier flying through the air that caused me to have all these thoughts that I've just now shared with you. So I will go on to a more mundane discussion of more materialistic things, and that is donations to the cost of my work here have been practically non-existent lately, except for my two or three faithful ones who know who they are. So I was especially happy to receive something in my mailbox this past week. It was a book and a CD with $40 cash enclosed. It was from Bob H. I believe he's in Idaho, as best I can tell, and a nice note. And I'm going to read the note to you. He said, Carolyn, here are a couple items I bought at the used bookstore so that they would not fall into the hands of innocent minds. And he means that. You know, I think he goes to these, he likes to go and look through books. And when he finds ones that he thinks are not good for the general public to be reading, he buys them if they're cheap enough and, to take them out of circulation. So that's what he did with these two. He sent them to me, and he says, I had previously sent you a work by Wiesel that had been heavily annotated by some poor soul. And that's true. He had sent me a copy of Night that he had found in the used books. And it was written all over by obviously a high school girl or even younger who just thought it was, believed every word of it and just was going, oh, how horrible, and all this stuff all over the book. And so he took that away from anybody who might want to find it. And he goes on to say, I thought you would be interested in the Auschwitz book since you have indeed written the book on the subject. Well, that's nice of him. He says, please accept the enclosed donation for the radio shows and website. Bob. Now, I want to talk for just a minute about this, about the book especially. I haven't even, I haven't put the CD on, but the book looked very interesting, and the title of it is We Won't See Auschwitz. It's written by, it's done in a comic book or cartoon style. It's all black and white drawing, line illustrations with either text handwritten underneath or the balloon things, you know, with handwritten in it. So, and this person who wrote it is Jeremy Drez, D-R-E-S, a French Jew, who obviously takes his Jewishness and the experience of Jews in what he considers a hostile world very seriously, even though he did this thing in a light type of style, and which makes it easy to read. And I am actually, as I'm going to tell you, I'm going to read this, and I'm going to talk about it some more, because this author did the book in this way because it says that he is he's worked in multimedia, he's a graphic designer and illustrator, so he's done comic stuff before. He has a Frenchified first name, his last name is Drez, and his whole family went to France. Now, let's see what I've got here in my notes. What the story is that he and his brother go to Poland to learn about what happened to their grandmother and find her grave. And in one place, he says, I just read part of the end of it. He says, Poland is not a country, but a cemetery. In that, you know, he really seems to believe that Poland was a place for Jews. And without the Jews, they think that the Jews are all gone from there. And that's what they've been told. And so Poland doesn't exist anymore. It's just a cemetery full of dead Jews, the Jews who were murdered and so on. That just tells me a lot about this mentality. So I'm looking forward to finding the time, and I will find it, to read this and let you know what I learn about it. It shows also how valuable it is to follow your impulses, like Bob does and did, to send things to people if you feel like it's the right thing to do. Usually it is, if you get a strong enough feeling. Because today, the topic is Auschwitz, and it will be continuing for a while on that topic, so it's very timely. And although I want to tell you that next Saturday, I'm expecting Eric Hunt to be with me to introduce his new video about Majdanek, which is not Auschwitz, but it is in Poland, and it is a very similar story. The story of Majdanek is very similar to the story of Auschwitz. It's just Majdanek is not as big and it has not gotten the attention that Auschwitz has, but it's very similar to the narrative of that place. And the Saturday after that, on December 13th, I'm expecting a wonderful program on Christmas music in the Third Reich with Margaret Hufstickler. And then on the 20th, and maybe the 27th too, I will probably take off for the Saturday show. And that's because I still have more to do. I got a lot accomplished in this past week that I took off for Thanksgiving, I feel so good about it. Boy, I really broke through some things I've been worrying about for a year, for the last year, and not doing anything about it, mainly about it all has to do with the Wilhelm Christman archive that I have on my Carolyn Yeager website. It's called WLK Archive. And I just set that aside and haven't done anything for a whole year, if not longer than that, I think. And it's been bothering me, and I needed to do some things in order to be able to move forward with it. And I finally pushed through with that. And it's very hard for me, I have to tell you, to tackle things that I don't feel competent in and don't have sufficient assistance and I don't want to bother people, and I don't even want to deal with new things. and so I spent the year I did the Willy Wenger archive. And so I thought I was, you know, doing that. That was good, and some other things I did. But I left Wilhelm Christman to just languish there. But now if you've looked there or if you want to look there, you see I've added some things. But I still have a long way to go, a lot to do to make it into what it will be and can be. So I need more time yet for that. I'll probably work on that over Christmas. So I'll take some time off then. Anyway, today, the overall theme is going to be really the insanity we are surrounded by. That most white people, the only ones I really am concerned with, most white people don't recognize as insane. And they should, but they don't. And that's one thing I totally agree with Andrew Anglin about. He often comments on the insanity we live in and how it's just incredible that it goes on the way it does. For instance, just yesterday he wrote, "We are living in a bad acid trip. I never really understood what a bad acid trip was. Now I understand. It is when nothing makes any logical sense. Reality appears to be collapsing, and everything is coming at you without mercy and without attempting to explain why it is coming at you." I think he was speaking about the Ferguson business and all of that, but it's all ties in together. It's all insane, and that's my approach and what I believe too. Whenever I have to be confronted with the new Holocaust news and so on, it's just and everything to do with what the Jews are saying and doing about themselves in the news. Now, I'm going to start with what is not with Auschwitz itself today, but what is more inane, if not insane, is the big news that came out on November 26th that a few 75-year-old rotten shoes were taken from the hundreds of thousands that are kept in two gigantic wire bins at the Majdanek death camp. They call it a death camp still in the... I was at the Telegraph and a few other places, but it was, November 26th, yes, that this news came out day before our Thanksgiving here. And it's just incredible. I put the picture of these bins in the room, in the barrack that they're in, on the show announcement, which you can see them there, how stupid. And I've seen this, you know, at Auschwitz, in their exhibits, all the old shoes that they have, plus old hair and old luggage and old eyeglasses, and it's also disgusting to look at because the stuff is just like rotting away. You know, it's just horrible, ugly, and that's what they want. And yet, it's amazing. You'd think people would say, "Wow, what is this? This is dumb." No, they instead, so many people are emotionally affected by it. So this is part of the incredible way that they play on people. But this story is so wild because they're talking about it like it's just such a horrible affront to every Holocaust survivor and to all, I don't know, moral standards in the world and so on. That one thing you can't do is do any kind of vandalism at a memorial campsite and so on. And what they say in the article is so true of how they use this stuff. This is somebody in the Majdanek Museum spokeswoman said, "The shoe exhibit has a strong emotional impact, and it is set in this barrack number 52A that visitors realize." It is in this barrack that visitors realize just how many people died during Reinhard. So this is the kind of thing they use rather than factual information or actual historical information. They use things like this, as we all know. And the unfortunate thing is that it works. It doesn't work on someone like Andrew Anglin. It doesn't work on me, but it does work on an amazing number of people who are set up to believe it, and actually, I've talked about this before, obviously they want to believe it. If they didn't want to believe it, they would see what's wrong with it. She goes on to say, "In this barrack, we only have the shoes of the victims, and that shows the massive nature of the crime." Well, they don't know that these are the shoes of the victims. They don't know whose shoes they are. In fact, it turns out that Majdanek, and you'll hear this from Eric, Majdanek was the place that all the other camps and detention centers and so on sent old shoes, too. They sent their old shoes to Mydonic, because Mydonic had, they had created there a, like a shoe repair business, shoe repair shop thing. And so that's what they were doing there. They were, if shoes could be repaired or parts of the shoes could be salvaged and put with some others for the, both for the soldiers, I guess, but maybe for some of the Wehrmacht service people who were working in the back, so not so much the ones on that were fighting in the front. But and also, though, the Germans back home who were doing without more and more and needed so much help. And shoes were a real problem, so here they were trying to recycle, going back to the recycling theme, all of these, you know, what they could from these old shoes. So what did they do when the Russians found them there? They said, oh, boy, look at this, and they turned it into a, you know, an exhibit that supposedly proved that all these people had their shoes were here because their shoes were taken when they were sent to the gas chamber. And this was all the people who were gassed there. And, of course, that's not true because there's estimated to be about 800,000 pairs of shoes, something like that I read. But they got the number of those who were killed or died at Majdanek down to 78,000, and this is an official figure. So there's no way they can match this together. But nobody seems to care. They want to go in there. They want to see that. And you can see in the photograph how long these bins are. The one at Auschwitz wasn't this big. And the reason that they had so many shoes, as I said, why these bins are like, looks like I'm practically a mile long. Of course it's not, but, you know, 10 or 20 feet long or something, packed with these shoes from bottom to top. And so you can see why they had them there, because they had this shoe repair business going on there. Or more, you might more say shoe salvage business, and see what they could salvage from them. Anyway, the other thing about this crazy story, why it's so insane, is that they say that 8 pairs of shoes were taken. And, you know, that the wire mesh was cut in some place and 8 pairs of shoes were taken out. They even know that 6 of them were adult shoes and two pair were children's shoes. Now, how do they know that? How do they know that? They haven't caught the people. Or were the shoes, did they find the shoes laying around somewhere in the camp that they were just dropped there later by the people that took them? I didn't read that. I didn't read anything like that. So this story doesn't make any sense to me. And they don't have cameras in this particular barrack. They have cameras elsewhere, but not in this barrack. I guess they didn't think anybody would ever do anything in here because there's nothing there but these bins of shoes. It's very gloomy looking. Well, I don't know. None of this is explained. All they want to do is put out this news that somebody's stolen something from this camp and how terrible it is. Now, there's a, to go along with this, that's all I'm going to say about that. To go along with this, there was a story a year ago. Well, not quite a year ago. It was actually took place, the story actually came out last January 27th, 2000 of this year. So, you know, the date, January 27th, is the date of the supposed liberation of Auschwitz-Birkenau and the date of the memorial day for it worldwide for Holocaust survivors or victims, I should say. And it came out on that day that an employee of this museum, Majdanek, was charged with anti-Semitism along with 5 other men. And they were arrested and charged with incitement to create hatred after they put up some posters in Lublin, which read, Zionists leave Lublin, or they wanted Zionists to leave the city. So this was a terrible crime in Poland because it had to do with their precious concentration camps there. So these men were arrested. And there was a big internal investigation at the museum, the Majdanek Museum. The day, what is more insane? Well, that's it for that story I wanted to tell you about. And I don't know what happened to these people. I don't have that in here. But of course, they were fired, and they no doubt were put on trial, and said that they would spend 7.5 years in prison if they were found guilty of putting up this poster asking Zionists to leave their city. See? Now, leaving aside Majdanek now, we'll talk about that more next week, what is more insane than the Auschwitz-Birkenau Memorial Museum in Poland and the liberation they celebrate? Yeah, they celebrate it every year on January 27th. The whole place, the whole Auschwitz-Birkenau is illogical and without substance. And yet it's very important to them because it is the most complete, it has the most buildings and so on, original things than any other place. And all of these, all what's most complete about it is in Auschwitz I, which was a work camp composed mostly of Poles and some Germans and, you know, political prisoners were there, and they had nice barracks to live in, actually. They even had flush toilets, and they had nice mattress beds, and they had grass and flowers outside. The whole thing has been just misrepresented completely. This is what they want to show to the public, because there's something actually there, whereas the other ones, there's not much there. And there is some stuff at Majdanek, but like I say, I'm not too familiar. And of course, Eric will hopefully be here next week. I know he never makes as much progress as he thinks he will, and that's the way I am too. And I think most people. I mean, you think you can finish something in a certain amount of time, and then you know it just doesn't go that way. But I still that's why we've been putting it off. But I still hope he'll be here next week. If not, he'll eventually be here. And anyway. Because it's a question of whether he wants to wait until his video is ready to be viewed by everyone rather than talk about it and nobody can look at it yet. So, anyway, the United Nations has set aside January 27th every year as a Holocaust Remembrance Day, which they officially named, and this they like long names, particularly communists like long names, International Day of Commemoration in Memory of the Victims of the Holocaust. That's the full name of it. And that's why the website, January27.org, that was set up last year to be a kind of a counter or a response to this UN commemoration, has a long name, and that name is the International Day of Commemoration in Honor of Revisionists who introduced sanity to the Auschwitz death camp narrative, death camp being in quotes. You can go to January27.org and see that. What they're doing, because this year, the year 2015, on January 27th, 2015, less than 2 months from now, it will be the 70th anniversary of what they call the liberation of Auschwitz-Birkenau. And so the camp museum memorial at Auschwitz-Birkenau gets involved too. And from the very beginning in 2006, when they had first had this commemoration, the UN did the camp at the museum memorial at Auschwitz-Birkenau did their own kind of commemoration and invited people and so on and had some activities going on there. And they've done that every year since. So they've got something big planned for this coming one in January 2015 because it is the 70th anniversary. And you know, I mean, the 70th year, you know how it is with when we have these certain kind of numbers come up, you have to make a big play, just particularly the 50th and the 75th and 100th. But I knew they would do something big on the 70th, and they have. And they put up a new website, a special website, I should say, called 70.auschwitz.org. 70.auschwitz.org. And from what I've seen of it, I have to say, I really believe this, although I'm not a person to usually talk like this. I usually am very overly modest, but I do believe that they're quite aware of, now this isn't the UN, this is the Auschwitz-Birkenau Memorial people. And they're quite aware of the website, January27.org, and what it said and what it's done. Even though it's not a site that many people go to, because how many people know about it and how many people pay attention to Holocaust stuff anyway? And, of course, the mainstream of any type is not going to mention it. So it doesn't get, but I do believe it gets the attention of the competition amongst the Holocaust industry. I believe that very much, because you can see what they've done here. They've done some things to counter some of the criticism that was that appeared on the January27.org site. And one thing they've done is to give a story of their liberation. If you go, if you're on the site, you don't have to be, but if you're on the site, you go to liberation on the top menu, the liberation. You'll find a story by me, and then following that, something from a book from Carlo Mantonio. And in this article by me, I point out that this liberation story, there was nothing to it, you know, and that there was no liberation, and all the things that actually took place and how they took place and all the questions that are involved in that. And then I say somewhere, now, you know, I don't have that here, but I say somewhere that on neither the Auschwitz-Birkenau Memorial Museum website or at Yad Vashem or at United States Holocaust Memorial Museum website do they have any detail whatsoever about the so-called liberation of Auschwitz-Birkenau on January 27, 1945. But they say it, they give that those facts and so on, and they give that information, but they don't tell you anything about it. So this time they have tried to write something about it, and it is, well, it's on their site, and I read it all. I don't know whether I want to go through all that now. Maybe I'll wait and see how it goes. But they do give quite a few paragraphs on a page. If you follow their menu, you'll find it on the liberation. And they do a lot of tricky stuff. For one thing, they don't have a single source on that page, on their narrative, for where the information came from, or, you know, why it can be counted on. They don't do that. And I believe it's because they don't want anyone to think that they're required to do that. If they would start giving sources for things, then they would be like, well, now where's your source for this and where's your source for that? But they never do that. You see, they just tell you what happened in their little story narrative form, and then people are supposed to accept that they are the experts. They are the museum of the Auschwitz Museum. They know everything. They have all the history there. They have all the records. They have all the information. And therefore, you can trust everything they say. They're just telling you the truth. That's why I think they do it that way. Because you can't accuse them of not saying where things come from. You know, certainly in this story, you can't. I think that they put that there this time because of what is on the, well, maybe even because of this one article. And there's the next one by Carlos Mantonio is also very, very good. I mean, I shouldn't say also, it's very, very good, and it's very hard-hitting, and it's taken from one of his books. And it's not a very well-known book either. So they're reacting, and they're trying to do a better job. So this year, for the 70th, they've got this whole website supposedly answering all the questions and so on. And a couple of things that I thought were noticeable, were, you know, worth mentioning, are that they have what they call the 18 pillars of remembrance. And they make a big deal out of that, the 18 pillars of remembrance. And what this is actually private citizens or organizations. They're the pillars who donate large amounts of money to them and support the ongoing cost of maintaining Auschwitz-Birkenau. And so they call them 18 pillars, and they've got a big wall at the entrance to the State Museum, the AB State Museum. And they've got these people's names engraved on their on that wall, whether they're individuals, or they mostly are, or sometimes organizations. And they're looking, they were needing, said they needed $120 million, I think. And then they managed to raise $102 million. And this is probably annually. This is not one time. This has to be annually for their operating budget and so on. And of course, they get supported by the Polish government. But it's just like the New York Holocaust Museum. No, I'm sorry, Washington, D.C. Holocaust Museum. They have money from the government, but that's not enough. They want tons of money to do all the work that they're doing. And so they get it from private individuals too. And so they come up with this idea that these people are pillars, pillars of remembrance. And they're acknowledged on that wall, like I said. And then they say here, so cornball-y, they say, the 18 pillars of remembrance will sit in the first row with survivors and heads of state, and the commemoration of the 70th anniversary of the liberation, blah, blah, on January 27th. So, you know, it's like they give them this, you know, they're buying special privileges by doing this, so they get to sit in the front row with the survivors and heads of state and crap like that. So, you know, they're honored, and so they still need one more. They need $8 more million to reach their goal, and they're still looking for another pillar to supply that to them. And then where they have the acknowledgments for this special occasion of the 70th anniversary, they want to thank the following. Okay, who are they? Well, first the Chancellery of the President of Poland. And this is all very important to Poland. When people want to say, oh, you know, it's just the Jews in Poland that want this or that like this. No, no, it's all Poles, because it's very important to their prestige and its income. It's important tourist income. So those two things. And then after the President of Poland, the Ministry of Culture and Natural Heritage, so more Polish government. Then the World Jewish Congress. Then the Auschwitz-Birkenau Foundation, which is a bunch of Jews. Then the UC Shoah Foundation, which is, of course, Steven Spielberg and his Jews. Even after he goes, it won't matter, because this foundation is all set to go on and on and on and on. So and then after the Shoah Foundation, the March of the Living International. Well, that's that association that organizes all those Jews and kids from Israel and school kids from everywhere and so on to come to Auschwitz-Birkenau once a year with a bunch of old survivors. Irene Zizblatt was attended that a few times and with all the kids. And they call it, and they march through the camp, you know, with their flags and stuff, and to stand up for remembering genocide and stand up for what happened there and all that. That's the March of the Living International. That's all Jewish, too. And then they have here the Polish National Radio Symphony Orchestra, which is doesn't even, I don't know if it even belongs there, because it contributes playing music, but I don't think it contributes any money. But they're thanking them because they put on a symphony a performance town of Auschwitz. I'm going to call it that because I can't pronounce the Polish name for it during the commemorations time. And then after that, Edelman, which is a government protection bureau and other service. Edelman's, I don't know, this is confused here, but Edelman is a private company business. It's obviously owned by Jews, but very big worldwide company, and they're a big supporter. And then the police and the public library, well, they're not giving money, and they're just helping out. There's going to be more on this coming up, this big 70th anniversary of the so-called liberation of Auschwitz. And the liberation, as I've said, was you can read about it in a lot of places, but you can read about it at January27.org. That they created it afterwards, that there was such a thing. And it doesn't hold up. Most everything that they say about it doesn't hold up at all. So it's just a big phony deal, which is good, because there's a lot that can be attacked about it for that reason. But they're stuck with it. I always say they're stuck with January 27th for their annual big Remembrance Day for the Holocaust, and they can't change the date. I wouldn't think they could. Of course, they can do anything they want to, and they can get away with it because of the media support. But, you know, they're kind of stuck with the January 27th and somehow justifying upholding the fact that there was a liberation, which can be disputed quite easily. Now, I'm going to go on to some more crazy stuff about Auschwitz-Birkenau and the 70th anniversary. There was a story about a teacher from the Ripley Academy who is one of the 25 in the world chosen to be a supporter, actually to be on some kind of panel for the 70th anniversary. And his name is Steve Richardson. There's a picture of him. And I have a picture of him on the blog talk, where the various pictures are showing up. It's clear from the picture that he's Jewish, so they don't say he is, but he's been working with the Holocaust for a long time. He's devoted to it, to Holocaust education. He's a teacher at this school in the United Kingdom called the Ripley Academy, and he's been chosen, and he was chosen by the Shoah Foundation, Spielberg Shoah Foundation, who actually has created another event that's called Eyewitness to go along with this 70th anniversary. So they're quite involved in all this, anything to do with Holocaust stuff. They're quite involved, and they're so rich that they, you know, they have plenty of money to contribute, and they also contribute like film crews and, you know, media, all kinds of help they do. So this guy, there was a story about him, and he's so thrilled, you know, that he was chosen. Says there will be teachers from 11 different countries, including the USA, Australia, Rwanda, Finland, Croatia, and the Czech Republic. It's going to be a workshop. They're going to run this, do this. The workshop is going to be run as part of something called Past is Present, Auschwitz.com. This is a project that is sponsored by the Shoah Foundation of Spielberg. See, there's Eyewitness, there's Past is Present, there's this, sorry if I'm confusing myself here, this might be what he's involved with, Past is Present Workshop. And there's a website for that itself, www.pastispresentauschwitz.com. And it's a global project, okay, for the 70th anniversary, sponsored by the Spielberg Foundation. And one of the quotes from there, they say, this is from Steven Spielberg himself. He says, these survivors who are now educators, they can change the world. Well, that's the purpose of all this, is to get these people, get them over there, get them together, and get them all worked up, you know, and turned on, and to create things that can be turned into teaching materials for teachers that can be sent all around the world. And that's what the Shoah Foundation is willing to do, to take all this, to take whatever they come up with and make things into lesson plans and so on, and send them everywhere, all around the world in the various languages and so on. And it goes on to say, and now you can too. Teachers, enter to join an international group of 25 teachers. This is the one that I was just talking about. It's over with now. And the purpose is to connect students with the past, engage them in the present, and motivate them to build a better future. So Mr. Richards was chosen. It says that during the workshop, he will work with a website called Eyewitness, which I just told you about, which brings together testimonies from survivors and witnesses of genocide, including the Holocaust. He will also meet with a large number of Holocaust survivors. How many of these people are there? Before the commemoration ceremony, can't you just imagine wanting to meet these damned old survivors? I don't mean to make fun of old age, but, they're not just old, they're liars. These people telling their stories, who'd want to meet them? And when you see pictures of them, you don't particularly want to meet them. But anyway, it's supposed to be a great honor. It says a virtual field trip is also being created to bring the 70th anniversary commemoration directly into the classrooms. So there's method to this madness, and they use everything as an opportunity to provide more and more education to the young about to teach them what they want them to think, which is why, no matter how insane this stuff is, that none of these people are interested in finding that out, nor do they think it can be, because they're so indoctrinated already by it all. You can overcome indoctrination, but most people are not motivated to do so. Once they've been indoctrinated, they just stick with it. They don't want to go against it. They don't feel any reason why they should care, for the most part. So there you go. That's how this all works. This guy, Steve, says, I was very surprised to be chosen, but I felt honored, and I feel a sense of responsibility to ensure my experiences are passed on through my teaching to my students. Yeah, see, he just gets all enthused about it all. It says, Holocaust education has always been important to Mr. Richardson, who has been involved in organizing student visits to Auschwitz. That's why he was chosen, because he's already passionate about it. He says, I'm passionate about the value of Holocaust education, the lessons to be learnt, and the importance of engaging young people in future genocide prevention awareness. Well, I'll bet he's passionate about it because he's Jewish. And all Jews are interested in that, so practically all. Well, he goes on and on like that. I don't see anything else that's too important, except that this workshop is going to begin in Poland on January 23rd, 2015, at the Museum of the History of Polish Jews. You know, we talked about that a while ago, this new museum that was inaugurated. Oh, what's his name? The movie producer who's the U.S. wants to extradite. There he is. Polanski. Roman Polanski. He was at the museum of at the opening of the Museum of the History of Polish Jews. And the same old group of Polish president and all the Polish dignitaries and so on were all there too. They're very, very friendly with Jews, and part of the reason is their history that they want to promote to the world is tied up with Jewish history. So if they would lose interest in the Jews, well, then they wouldn't. Their history would not be important either, and could be debunked. But it's not just that. But they're globalist. They're part of the globalist structure, so they all have to support all of this, and they do. But this workshop is going to be there at the Museum of the History of Polish Jews, and it's going to start on the 23rd, 4 days before the big day of the 27th. So they're working in a little bit ahead there, and whatever they come up with, I'm sure they'll be mentioned there. And then we have the story of this horrible Kitty Hart Moxon. Yeah, she's in the news again. She is one horrible person. She's an extraordinary. They call her the extraordinary. Her extraordinary story as a concentration camp survivor. Well, she's an extraordinary liar, is what she is. And the things that she has written and said are just absolutely crazy and unbelievable. And yet nobody questions her. And right now she's in the news because she's done something with a couple of girls, young 15-year-old girls she's gone to Auschwitz and walked around and talked about things, and with these two 15-year-old girls accompanying her to make an impression, and they're making a film or something, I don't know, and to make the impression on other young people. Again, they target the young people to get the young people to think that Kitty Hart Moxon's story is important, because these girls are there with her who they can relate to and are their age. 15, they say, that's the perfect age to teach about the Holocaust. That's what they say, 15, where they still have this idealism and they're young enough not to be cynical. So she's doing that, and she's telling a bunch of crazy things in this, in I suppose what is going to be a documentary of some kind. So here's what she has written that is quoted in this Daily Mail story. And it is, she says, arrival in Auschwitz is a defining moment in your life. The doors open. You are thrown out, greeted by barking dogs, screaming figures with whips, a stench of burning flesh in a glow of fire. See, none of that is true. But she's still saying those things, that there are barking dogs and people with whips screaming at you. And you're smelling burning flesh and seeing fire off in the distance, you know. Crazy. And she says, everything happens at breakneck speed. This is old stuff here, but she's still using it. Out, 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 they say. You know that. Rouse, rouse, rouse. You are driven off running. You are taken to a building, stripped, put under cold showers, driven to the next hall where they shave off your hair. There are no towels, so you are still wet and cold. That's not, that was never true. Then women prisoners smear your body with a mop dipped in green fluid, which stings. In the next hall, you are thrown some rags and wooden clogs. In the final hall, there are women sitting at tables with funny pins in their hands. And before you know it, needles are piercing your skin. That is when you become a number, and it gives her a number. Whistles blow, and there is a roll call. Thousands of women are rushing to stand in line. For hours, you stand in the rain, and people fall to the ground dead. Then you are driven into a hut, and you think, at last, I can lie down. But you can't. There are 1,000 women trying to lie down on the bunks. You're lucky to find a corner to cling to. Welcome to Auschwitz. Welcome to hell. Oh my! This was printed just recently in the Daily Mail, as being testimony. Yeah, well, that's her testimony. Her testimony is. Then it goes on to say, she is a direct witness to mass murder, and quoting her again. From our hut, I looked out on the gas chamber in crematorium number 4. She gestures to her sitting room wall, maybe 3 meters from our chairs. She was giving an interview here to somebody. That's how close I was. I saw people going into a building and never coming out. I saw the SS go up on ladders and empty tins of white crystals, which produced poison gas. That's not from her. She says, She saw the SS go up on ladders and empty tins of white crystals into a hole in the roof. This is on Crematory 4. I heard screams a few minutes later. She heard screams. I saw smoke and fire and men wheeling barrels of ash. That went on 24 hours a day. At one point, an SS woman escorted some of us back to the main camp on an errand. We were taken around the outer perimeter past the woods at the back. There they were driving people alive into burning pits. This, and she goes, there's more of this, you know, but I thought this was some of the most crazy of all. It's just unbelievable. Nobody should believe any of that, but somebody like her gets away with it. And not only that, Queen Elizabeth, not so long ago, awarded her the OBE. Queen Elizabeth awarded the Order of the British Empire to this liar. This absolute ignorant liar. That shows how deep it all goes and how bad it all is. The uprising, she goes on, she mentioned something else here that's worth saying. She said, she's talking about how she witnessed the uprising of the crematorium workers, you know, the revolt at the crematorium, who destroyed that crematorium before the rest of them were destroyed by the Germans, supposedly. And she says that the uprising of 250 Jewish crematorium workers who broke through the outer fence after setting fire to the building, that is, they broke out of the camp after they set fire to the crematory. 250 in one crematory, 250 of them were there, and they broke and they escaped. How could there be so many crematory workers? Those crematories are not that big. What was there for them all to do? There couldn't be 250 of them there. There was no room for all that, plus the people that are supposed to be bringing in there. Everything is so, we go back to the acid trip, you know, the insanity of it. It makes no sense, and yet you're supposed to accept it, and people do, and believe it without asking any questions. Oh, so this, here's the two girls that were attending Lily, what's her name? Kitty Hart Moxon, attending her for this documentary that she was making at Auschwitz just recently, you know. And one of them's name was Lydia Hollingsworth. And now, you know, Kitty has lived in United Kingdom for a long time. That's where they went after the end of the war, she and her mother. Boy, she was a homely-looking girl, too. Short, squat, and with thick legs. And she kind of covers it up today, but she was no beauty, I'll tell you that. But anyway, this Lydia Hollingsworth, there were two young English girls, one of them from Harpenden. She said of the filming experience, this is how gullible these youngsters are, who are supposed to be so smart today. I don't go along with how smart they're supposed to be. They're smart about things that are part of the world that they have lived in their short number of years, but that's all. She says it was a real honor to be with Kitty as she recounted what she had to go through just to survive day by day. Well, she knows what she's supposed to say, and she says it. We hope, she says, she probably got help writing this all out ahead of time. She said, we hope that people our age will be able to learn from Kitty to make sure that nothing like this ever happens again. Well, that's the exact thing they're trying to get across to all the young people, so that's exactly what she's saying. They want to reach people their age, you know, mid-teenagers, and make sure that nothing like this ever happens again, which means that anti-Semitism is out, 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 and multiracialism is in forever, to make sure that nothing ever happens to people like happened then to the Jews and others, supposedly. And we don't want that ever to happen again. Therefore, we have to just care for everyone, be nice to everyone, don't ever dislike anybody because of their race or their nationality or their ethnic or their beliefs or anything. You know, we're all going to be in this happy, lovey world. This is what the Jews want us to believe in. And then she goes on to say, this Lydia Hollingsworth, 15 years old, she said, it made me quite emotional being here. That's the whole point of it, you see. Made me quite emotional being here, learning about her suffering and thinking about all those people who were murdered. It also made me think that Kitty was my age when she was here in this terrible place. I guess this is still her. We want to be able to help educate our peers. Yes, it is. See, she's supposed to be promoting now this to people her age about the Holocaust and to remind them what Kitty and so many others went through, many of whom did not survive. Well, what about Kitty's stories about the whips and the dogs and the, you know, all the things that the pouring white crystals into a hole in the roof and so on, all the things that don't fit the actual facts and scientific evidence at all. But no, that doesn't. None of that comes up. See, it just doesn't come up. It's ignored. And this is supposed to be the mainstream historians, mainstream journalists, and so on. They go along with all that. Now, the fact is that others who were there said that there weren't because there were no holes in the roof, that that they were throwing this crystals in through a window, into the supposed gas chamber room, through a window. But she says that she saw him go up on ladders. I think she's about one of the only ones that says that. But nobody questions that or tells her to stop saying it, or she probably wouldn't anyway. She's a woman who's out of control and doing whatever she wants to do, saying whatever she wants to say, and she's getting up. They just treat her better and better the more outrageous she becomes. Now, I got some of this from Further Glory at scrapbookpages.com. He's the one who said that other Holocaust survivors who were witnesses to the supposed gassing of Jews in Crema 4, it's Crema 4 is what we're talking about, thank you, have testified that the gas pellets were thrown into the room through the windows in the wall of Crema 4. And another one of these liars, Alice Locke Kahana, who was in Crema 4, 5, next door to Crema 4, said that about it. And Crema 4 and 5 were actually crematoriums where the bodies of the dead were cremated. And they had shower rooms in them, which I've talked about before. They're known to have had shower rooms, and it's these shower rooms that were afterwards called gas chamber rooms. And they talk about how they had these shower heads in the wall and the ceiling, but the people, that was so that the fool people, so that they'd go in there, and then the gas came instead. And one thing I left out here that for, oh, God, wouldn't you know, this documentary and the interview and so on of this Kitty Hart Moxon, who is one of the biggest liars I've ever come across, was funded by the Shoah Foundation. And the Shoah Foundation sent a film crew from L.A. to film Kitty and Lydia Hollingsworth and the other girl, they don't mention her, in Auschwitz. And the documentary is going to be shown on 200 channels across the world. It will also be sent out to all schools across America. Isn't that nice? And at the end of the filming in Auschwitz, probably the end of the film, Kitty stood in front of the pond in which the Nazis had dumped the ashes of the victims. See, that's stated there, and it's probably going to be in the film. Here's the pond where the Nazis dumped all these ashes of all these hundreds of thousands of cremated bodies. And has it ever been demonstrated that the pond is full of ashes? Not to my knowledge, it hasn't. No, there's never been any proof of any of this, but they just keep saying, well, what would, you know, oh, this, look at this pond. This is where the Nazis dumped all the ashes. Oh, that's why we can't find them anymore. They're all in that pond. Well, wouldn't it have filled up that pond and then some? And there wouldn't be any more water left in it, but it looks like an ordinary pond there. Okay, so I have a little editorial part here that says, I ask, what is wrong with Poland and the Polish people? And, you know, I'm critical of Poland and Polish people, but, you know, I they're selfish. It's one thing about the war and their attitude and their stories about how the Germans treated them, but it's another thing about the Holocaust. And I say, I guess this is me saying this, is their selfish, ghoulish love of Holocaust and Holocaust death stories, such as the latest theft of 8 rotten, deteriorating, and stinky old shoes from that gigantic collection of thousands in the wire mesh bins, as being proof that the people who these shoes belong to were killed. Well, that's what's wrong. You know, I guess they know better. They know better. They have to know better. I'm not talking about the average person, but I'm talking about the authorities. They know better. But they pull that stuff. They do that. And that shows something very wrong with the kind of people that they are. The shoe exhibit has a strong emotional impact. Well, I already read that above by this museum spokeswoman. And they use it because this convinces people that all these people really did die there. It gives some big emotional hit to them. Yeah, well, I already read this part up above. I brought it down below here. So there's no reasoning in any of this. She says, it is difficult to place a material value on the stolen items. Of course it can't. You can't put a material value on those 8 pairs of shoes but that are 70 years old. But their real worth is their historical value, she added. What, you know, I say, what historical value do they have? She admits above that it's all done for the emotional impact. There's no historical value. I'm going to take a little break here, ladies and gentlemen, before I go on. Let's see what I have, how much I have left. Not so much, and then I'll take some phone calls if I have any, and I can also talk more about the liberation stories. So I will be back. I'm going to put on, I'm going to put on a very short song by Hans Albers I picked this one out because, you know, I'm in a fighting mood here and will be for a while now, up until the January 27th, and I want to inspire a fighting mood in as many of my listeners as possible and thinking about how to resist this kind of stuff that's going to be building up during the next couple of months. And so this is a song, this is Hans Albers' song, Lied der Flüchtlinge, and I'm not sure what that is, the Flüchtlinge. I have to look that up while during the break. A song of something. But it's a fighting song, you know. It's that song where he comes across with after the war, see, and you know, we're gonna come back. We're not beaten. We're Germany. We'll come back. And this is has a good attitude, and I want to tell you that I've become a real fan of Hans Albers. What a guy he was. So here's the song.
Lied der Flüchtlinge. Wir ziehen auf endlosen Straßen durch Tage und Nächte dahin, von Gott und den Menschen verlassen, ganz ohne Ziel, ohne Sinn. Wir wandern auf endlosen Wegen, getrieben, verfolgt vom Geschick, der trostlosen Zukunft entgegen. Wann finden wir zurück? Nur ein Dach überm Kopf und das tägliche Brot und Arbeit für unsere Hände. Dann kämpfen wir gern gegen Unglück und Not und zwingen das Schicksal zur Wende. Die Welt soll wieder schön in Freiheit und Frieden erstehen. Wir haben zwar alles verloren, doch wollen wir den Schmerz überstehen. Wir haben verzweifelt geschworen, wir wollen nicht untergehen. Wir lassen die Hoffnung nicht sinken, wir glauben trotz Tränen und Leid, dass uns bessere Tage winken in einer neuen Zeit. Aber ein Dach überm Kopf und das tägliche Brot und Arbeit für unsere Hände. Dann kämpfen wir gern gegen Unglück und Not und zwingen das Schicksal zur Wende. Die Welt soll wieder schön in Freiheit und Frieden erstehen. Die Welt soll wieder schön in Freiheit und Frieden erstehen.
All right, welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. No, I wasn't. The song was so short, I wasn't able to look up Flüchtlinge. And so I'm not going to take the time to do it now, because I'll have to have a quiet time while I do it. So But you can look it up. Let's see. It's spelled F-L-E-U-C-H-L-I-N-G-E. So, now here's something really crazy. I found this so interesting, and I almost used it for the picture, but it is on the Blog Talk screen that for this show, and it's a picture of what are supposed to be metal stamps that were used for tattooing prisoners by the authorities in the camps, and it says they were discovered in Poland. This is another story from the Telegraph. It was other places too, but I would rather get it from the Telegraph than from a Jewish site, because, boy, I hate going to those Jewish sites. They throw stuff at you like crazy. There's so much advertising that's just throwing it in your face all the time. It says under the picture of these little, looks like little torture items, that they're metal stamps with a few millimeter long needles used for tattooing KL Auschwitz prisoners. Well, you know, I thought at first that they had to have needles embedded in these little metal prongs that are on there. But they've got pointy metal shafts, but there's no needle in there. I think the needle is the pointy metal shaft. But gosh, I'm not sure what size these things are, but they can't be too small. Each one is supposed to represent a number. And the ones that were supposedly found have the number, I think they said they had a 2 and a 3 and a 9, which could also be used as a 6, something like that. And supposedly, these metal shafts, they call them stamps, but metal shaft things were stuck into a wooden block. So if that thing that's holding them is a wooden block, and then these things are stuck in there, and that's the needle thing. There's no needles. That's what they stick into the person's flesh. It doesn't look to me like you could get that unless those points were sharpened real sharp. Then you could maybe stick it into somebody's flesh. It would be very painful. I can't believe this story at all. And supposedly they pushed this into the flesh, each number separately, and then the ink was rubbed into the wound, and that's ended up being, when it healed, ended up being a tattoo. This is not what you read in many people who have written about it, who said that they had like needles with ink in them or something, and they just punched them in there until they had and made the numbers that way. But this is something else that is hard to figure out how they can be real. But they're running this story, and it says in there that the sight of a tattoo is getting rarer every day as former prisoners pass away. But these stamps still speak of the dramatic history that took place here even after all these decades. That's the person who's promoting this. That's what he said. So we get the idea that they're afraid that when there's no more people with tattoos around, that just like with the no more survivors, that their story is going to weaken, that it's not going to be as emotionally impactful for the general public. So now they're trying to come up with, obviously, something that proves that people were tattooed. He says that they will become a valuable exhibit in forthcoming exhibitions. Here's the thing. The museum has declined to say who discovered the stamps and where they were found, other than to confirm they were unearthed in Poland and that their finder wishes to remain anonymous. Now, that's very suspicious indeed. In fact, I think it's a bogus. It's bogus. Somebody made these things and is trying to pass them off. You know, you don't do that. You don't have these things that are going to prove historical facts and then say, they were found in Poland. Unearthed, they say. Unearthed? Unearthed in Poland somewhere. But the person who found them doesn't want to be known. Yeah, well, this is, this is some kind of a hoax, because a millimeter is 1/1000th of a meter, which is 5/127th of an inch, or 0.03 of an inch. So it's like the length of an average flea, or the diameter. No, that's a millimeter and a half. 1 millimeter is the diameter of a pinhead, it says. It's just like a pin. But these things, as you look at them, they don't have pinheads on them. They have like slanted, edged, coming to a point, but sort of flat. There's a length to them. It says 5 millimeters is the length of a red ant. And they're at least the length of a red ant. They must be awfully small, much smaller than they look in the picture. But they don't say also, they don't give a gauge for the size of what we're looking at. This is more of this fraudulent, insane crap that comes up that you have to call, you don't know why, what you're looking at, why people would put out stuff like this. I mean, it doesn't make any sense, but there it is. They'll do it. They'll come up with anything. Well, one more little thing I have here is that the current head of the Auschwitz-Birkenau Museum has been quoted as saying that there were hundreds of thousands of Jews were murdered in Auschwitz-Birkenau. He didn't say even a million. Didn't even say a million. He said in an article, and it appears in the New York Times, and his name is Piotr P-I-O-T-R, Cywinski. He's the Polish director of the Auschwitz-Birkenau State Museum, and he said Auschwitz-Birkenau, where hundreds of thousands of Jews from Poland, France, Germany, Hungary, the former Soviet Union, and elsewhere were murdered. And so one person who found this and questioned it was by Winston Smith, the Ministry of Truth blogger, Black Rabbit. He had a story on that. And I guess that's what I saw was referred to that. But it was in the New York Times, which you can find in 2011. February 19th, 2011. He said some other things too, that very few Jews ever set foot in Auschwitz I, which is true. I don't know if he said that, but a lot of people have said that. So that's pretty well accepted. They question him and say, is he a Holocaust denier? You know, if these official people can say these things, and it's okay. But if you're a considered a revisionist and you give a different figure, you're considered a lawbreaker, a criminal for spreading hatred of Jews and things like that that they call, if you don't go along with this story, you're doing it in order to be malicious and hateful. So, you get arrested and you get fined and so on. That's another aspect of this story that doesn't make sense. That should be brought up as often as possible with the people who believe. And I know that I understand that if you talk to people who believe it and you start to want to point these things out, they lose interest, they lose patience, they say, I don't care, I don't want to hear about it, I'm not interested, let's change the subject. They just don't want to think about it. They don't want to. I know that. And so people have the best of intentions, and I know how many of you try to talk to your family and so on, and they just get mad at you and don't want to hear about it. It's really too bad. It's so too bad. Here's something from this New York Times article on page 2, the one that I was just talking about. They make a good statement here it tells us something. It says, each generation has gotten the stories it wants from the site, from the Auschwitz-Birkenau site. You know, you just take from it what you want and create stories fit your needs. Under communism, Auschwitz served as a national memorial to Polish political prisoners who were the camp's first victims. Birkenau, where hundreds of thousands of Jews from Poland and France, that's where he makes that statement, saying hundreds of thousands were murdered. lapsed into neglect because it didn't fit the narrative. So at that time, the interest was all in Auschwitz I, so it was called Auschwitz. Now they've had to do a lot of work to get people to understand that it was also Birkenau and what happened at Birkenau in those crematoriums there that they want to say were also gas chambers. So that's another point, is that people take what they want from it. And at different times in history, in the short history, the 70 years, say, the 75 years, different things have been said. And different emphasis has been placed on what took place there. There again, it fits the political needs of the day. So the whole thing is political. The whole purpose of keeping the Holocaust alive is political. And even for the Jews, here's another thing I was thinking about last night, that there's something of a debate about who is most responsible for wanting to keep the Holocaust story alive, the whole hoax, I should say. Is it the U.S. military and the U.S. government and the other governments, the British government, the British military, so many people say it's the U.S. Army story that they justify what they did during the war, and the British too justify what they did during the war. That's true that they do, but I don't think that is as strong. They have that much as much of a need to keep it alive for that reason as the Jews have and Israel has to keep it alive for the state of Israel and for the status that the Jews have enjoyed ever since 1945 and increasingly got control of so much of the whole financial and governmental and legal structures of the all around, certainly in the Western world, and which is where it really counts, but all even going into the Middle East and so on, if not so much in the Far East, Australia and New Zealand, that area down there, areas all over, really got to where they are controlling the whole world. They're the ones who most need it. They are the ones who are today still behind all of it, supporting it, as you noticed from the names of the people who were the supporters of this 70th anniversary special events and so on. It's all Jewish organizations. That's who's behind it today. That's who needs it the most. And that's who's created it as to be what it is today for the most part. Even though the governments have their own reasons to go along with it, it's not as strong as what the Jews have. And the fact these Jews run these governments too. One thing has allowed, now they may have been able to pull it off without this Holocaust, holo-hoax, but it's still the fact is that we have allowed through just not understanding what was going on, just like these people today who don't want to hear about it, don't want to listen to it, don't want to know. They don't want to hear you tell them what you know about it. That's why this has been allowed to get so out of control, and we are completely out of control. We have so little power, it's not even funny. We're just probably being allowed, you know, we're being indulged to still operate and talk and use the internet and so on because we're not capable of putting an end to it. We're not capable of bringing it down. If we were capable of bringing it down, I suppose we wouldn't be allowed. There would be no indulgence for us. The situation is extremely dire and seriously horrible. And so we come to this another anniversary here, another event. This time they're going to go all out for the 70th anniversary, and we have an opportunity to do whatever we can do. They do know what we're doing. They do know. And they do watch it and do react to it. We have I hope that we will be doing something for this 70th anniversary, and we can use the January27th.org website, but there could be other other things going on, and I will be talking about that in the future, but I can't, we've got 2 months less than that, but I can't do much, you know. I hope that people will be thinking about this and will come up with some ideas, and we can pool our resources and at least do make another some steps forward from what got started last year with this website. And I hope you will visit the website and refresh yourself, reacquaint yourself with what's there. Every time I go there and look at it, I'm just impressed with how excellent it is and how excellent the contributions there are. And it just doesn't get any better. And any better than that, I don't think. And what I like about it, too, is that it's focused only on Auschwitz-Birkenau, because if that could be totally debunked, people will say, well, that's already been debunked. You know, that's already been defeated. Well, maybe people in the know, but it's still providing plenty of gist for the media and so on, and it's still being spoken about in exactly the same way. They're still going to be doing this 70th anniversary thing, so obviously it hasn't been defeated. It hasn't been. I'm going to, and anybody can call if you want to call if you have a comment, but I've got a little story here about Elie Wiesel, and I'm going to say a few things about that. I'm saying that Elie Wiesel will be there too. I'm sure he will be there. And I want to talk about his name. His name is, as far as I know, I think, I believe, his last name is pronounced Wiesel. Wiesel. It's not Wiesel. I guess it kills me when I hear people calling him Elie Wiesel. That's not, and he himself has said, and I have it on a radio show or something, he himself has said, when he was asked, how do you pronounce your last name? He said, Wiesel. Wiesel. It's like there's no accent on the second syllable, but it is a Z sound, not an S sound for in English, you know. It's a German, basically Yiddish German word, and S is pronounced like a Z, but the accent is equal on both syllables, Wiesel. So it's easy to then, you know, put more emphasis on the last syllable than you should. I realize how easy it is to do that when you're just speaking away. So, but anyway, I thought I'd bring that up. I think you can bet on Elie Wiesel being there, but I don't can't say for positive, you know, if they haven't announced it yet. Anything can happen to him. He's pretty frail. But he was at an event just in November, this month, earlier this month, at Cooper Union, and he was with that horrible Shmuley Boteach, the rabbi who's supposed to be, you know, just the most wonderful person. Everybody thinks so, you know, he's presented that way. He's just a big, he's all over the place, you know, promoting being the goodwill ambassador, I guess, for Jews. And so there was a kind of a discussion at Cooper Union in New York on genocide. And previously the Palestinian president Mahmoud Abbas had been there and had accused Israel of genocide. That was in September. And so that upset Elie Wiesel so much that he organized this thing with Shmuley to talk against anti-Semitism. The other people that were there was Samantha Powers, United Nations, U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. She's Jewish, I'm pretty sure, and part Jewish at least, or something like that. And Harvard professor Noah Feldman. So you have these four Jews there on a panel discussion, and it says that every time Elie Wiesel spoke, the audience went into a rapt silence. And here's what he said. He said, "Things change, anti-Semitism remains." Where did we go wrong? What did we do to deserve the hate? Why, you ask yourself, why? The questions are as old as Jewish history itself. Yeah, he's 86 now, and he keeps saying the same things, but here he's acting like he just doesn't understand, and he probably doesn't. He says everything changes, like the war and the Holocaust, and he thought after that anti-Semitism would disappear. He thought, that's what he always says that he thought. But yet we still have anti-Semitism. And he's asking, where did the Jews go wrong? What did the Jews do to deserve this? Why, we ask ourselves, why? And then he has to say, you know, as the answer, the questions are as old as Jewish history itself. It's like, well, there's just some kind of a hatred of Jews. Nothing, you know, nothing to do with Jews. They didn't do anything. They asked themselves what they could do, what they've done. But no, he doesn't get it. Well, Elie Wiesel does not get it. And if the person writing this says he spoke with a heavy accent that sounds French. You know, they just picked that up from people who said it before. Most of everything we read and know is just picked up from what people before have said. Most of what's in journalism is just copying what people before have said. And when it comes to Elie Wiesel, it's the same thing. You know, they look back and or they remember that people have said that his accent sounds French. Well, you know, he speaks French and he lived in France and he could have a French accent, but I've never been able to hear anything French. He sounds just like all the other Hungarian refugees, Hungarian Jews and so on that you find anywhere else speaking. That's the way it sounds to me. I may not be able to detect the French in it, but it's not very strong if there's any there. So Mr. Boteach was saying how the problem is getting worse, yet the high-level attention is going down, that they're not getting the attention from the high-level leaders that they used to get, and that they're very disappointed on that. They're very worried about it. And so it just mentions that there was a conference in Berlin on anti-Semitism, but they're not, that's about all that they've had going on in their favor. So, and then this discussion was organized by Mr. Boteach and his son Mendy, who is a New York University undergraduate student, and it was in response to the speech by Abbas at the Cooper Union. Now we have one more thing from Elie that he said. At the event, Mr. Boteach emphasized that Israel is not perfect, but human. Can you believe that? We're supposed to say, of course Israel's not perfect, but Israel, the thing is about Israel, is inhuman. Everybody can see they're inhuman, but he wants to say, well, they're not perfect, but they're human. We have to forgive them for their, you know, human mistakes and so on. And then he says he warned of the consequences of casting blame on an entire group of people and praised Mr. Wiesel for being the face of the 6 million faceless victims killed during the Holocaust. So there again they bring it up. Mr. Wiesel is the face of the 6 million faceless victims. Oh, they cannot ever stop that. It doesn't matter how many adjustments would be made at different camps or at different areas and regions and different events and so on. It doesn't matter how much revision would be made with the numbers. It's always going to be 6 million. You know that. They're always going to say 6 million. They have to. And that's another weakness, in my opinion, that they have that can be exploited greatly. Now, Wiesel, he references King Solomon. He loves to do that. He's always bringing up some Jewish biblical character. And he says, can we really learn from each other? If not, what are we doing here? If we can, why don't we? I believe we can. God has given man the power of birds. With these birds, we can build castles. We can bring hope or despair. It's always in our hands. I thought that was interesting because, you know, so hypocritical. He won't learn from anyone or anything. Nobody can teach him anything, and people have tried to point some things out to him, but he won't see a thing wrong with Israel, and not a thing. And so, but he thinks that we can learn from each other. He means you learn from me, but I'm not going to learn from you. Jews don't have anything to learn from anybody, as far as he knows. He's never said so. And then he says that God has given man the power of words, and that he's talking like that's the greatest power there is. Well, that's what Jews are good at. Jews work with words, and always have. And they trick people, and they do everything with words. They don't build castles. They're not builders they can copy how other people build or something. But they're not builders in real life. They're builders with words. And so he sees that as the main power that we have from God. And it's in our hands. That's sort of revealing. You know, we can bring hope or despair. It's in our hands. Well, he's still trying to convince people that the Jews stand for hope and good things for people and so on. But maybe it's true that if anti-Semitism is growing, that people are not falling for this like they used to. And let's hope that people are not falling for his stupid words. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I have 15 minutes to go, a little more than that, and I don't have any callers, and I don't think I need to talk about the liberation page. Well, maybe I'll go and take a quick look. No, I don't have anything bolded or anything on this page because I'm just right on the website. But maybe I'll mention something here that Carlo Mattonio has written. This is what's called Notes on the Liberation of Auschwitz-Birkenau by Mattonio. He says, I like this first paragraph. He says, the Soviets had already experienced the immense propagandistic power of their images of the liberation of Lublin Majdanek. When the Red Army reached Lublin Majdanek on 23rd July 1944, that's 6 months before they got to Auschwitz-Birkenau, you see. So 6 months earlier, they had already so supposedly liberated Majdanek. They found, among other things, the gigantic Cory 5 muscle crematory oven intact that was left behind by the Germans. Along with warehouses containing approximately 800,000 pairs of shoes. See? Based on a technically nonsensical expert report, in quotes, on the crematory capacity of the oven, this 5-muffle oven, and presupposing that the shoes were necessarily proof of murder, the Soviet transformed Lublin Majdanek into an extermination camp with 1.5 million victims. Well, see, it had never been thought of as an extermination camp, but when the Russian intelligence people and political commissars and so on got there, they looked to see what they had to work with, and they created a story about that camp. They did the same thing at Auschwitz-Birkenau. So they, you know, Carlo goes on. Majdanek Museum later revealed that the camp had a warehouse to which old shoes were sent from all the other camps for recycling purposes. The number of victims of the camp was revised twice downwards by the Majdanek Museum, which first lowered it to 360,000, then to 235,000, and finally, for now, to 78,000. The number of real deaths is about 42,000, according to Mattonio, but not murders, but deaths. As for the expert report, suffice it to say that it exaggerated the actual crematory capacity of the single oven by 1,000%. The world's daily newspapers were soon filled with images of the oven and the mountains of shoes in the camp, considered visible and irrefutable proof of the mass extermination allegedly perpetrated there. Now, that's why the Germans, having experienced that, And as he puts it, the suggestive power of images. This is why before they abandoned Auschwitz, they blew up the crematory at Birkenau and burned the warehouse barracks in the Effektenlager, containing inmate personal effects, burning them all except for six. That's what Matonio holds happened, that they did it, that they burned those lagers down. And I'm glad he uses the name, the proper name. Effektenlager means a warehouse that holds the, or barracks that holds the personal effects, you know, like clothes and furs and any other kind of valuables that people had, you know, or even shoes and all kinds of things, goods. So that's what that place was. But, you know, it's always called Canada. I'm so tired of hearing it called Canada, because Canada was just a name that inmates gave it, meaning that Canada was something that was far away and mysterious to them, and so was but supposedly wealthy. And so was these barracks. They had all this stuff in them, but it was kind of mysterious. So they call it Canada, but really that's not a proper name. And it was just an Effektenlager to hold the personal belongings of the prisoners that had come there. And they did go through them, and they did look for stuff that could be recycled and reused and so on, and they had different people working in there to do that. So they weren't saving it for these people, because they were going to send them... They weren't going to stay. They were going to send them further east, and so they wouldn't need those things. And so that was the deal there. So he just goes on to talk about all that, and he also talks about the numbers, the death numbers, and so on. And it's the same with the Auschwitz-Birkenau. You know, the numbers went from 4 million killed there, and then it was 3 million Jews and 1 million non-Jews. And then it went down to 1.5 million. They got more honest about it. And then it went down to 1.1 million. And now it's officially under 1 million, 900 and some thousand. So it's under a million at Auschwitz-Birkenau. And the same way that they did, that happened with Majdanek. But as I said, the number of 6 million remains the same. Okay, well, I think I've given my rationale pretty well for today's program, so I don't need to repeat it. This holofakery has really got to come to an end sometime, because the stuff that people are believing is so ludicrous, and it's based on absolute nothing, you know, nothing substantial whatsoever. And we're going to see a nice big display of what Jews can do, what Holocaust-supporting Jews can do in the next couple of months. And I'm going to be staying on top of the story, and I hope that it will, hope that other people will play it up, and we can maybe come together for some good events of our own. I think that would be a very good idea, and I'm open for suggestions. So all you have to do is write to me. And I might be more open than I was last year, because last year I was, it was just, you know, getting going, and I was kind of overwhelmed, and I didn't want to take on anything too big. So we'll see what we might come up with this year. I think it's important, and this 70th anniversary gives a real good opportunity for us to do something. So, ladies and gentlemen, thanks for listening today, and I do expect to be back next week and the week after on Saturday, and I will have a program on Monday evening, the Heretics Hour. So this has been Carolyn Yeager on Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn on November 29th, 2014. Good night. Good day, I should say.